Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Center for the Study of Europe, the Center for the Study of Asia, the Program in East Asian Studies, and the Undergraduate Economics Association at Boston University. Our speaker is Professor Kostas Lapavitsis from the Department of Economics at the University of London. Professor Lapavitsis's lecture is titled Profiting Without Producing, How Finance Exploits Us All. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Cornell Bam, Assistant Professor of International Relations at Boston University.
We're very fortunate to have Professor Lapavitsis here with us from the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London. A couple of words about our presenter. It would be fair to call you a heterodox economist, I suppose, and I see your work as being a very very interesting combination between Marxian and post-Keynesian understandings of finance. But before you wrote on finance, basically established your name as somebody working in issues of finance and development, particularly on Asia and the Japanese financial sector in particular. Those of you who are interested in aspects relating to industrialization in developing areas, Professor Lapavitsis has written extensively on the connection between industrialization and finance, on settings as different as the Ottoman Empire, Ottoman Macedonia, as well as the East Asian countries and their historical experience. So I would say finance and development, the structure of financial systems, as well as finance and industrialization would be the critical elements of your career in this regard. So in addition to being a post-Keynesian plus Marxist economist, I think that your work is unique in terms of the fact that it takes very seriously the social embeddedness of economics. So it's a very interdisciplinary approach that takes history seriously, takes sociology seriously, and engages with politics seriously, including the very baroque elements of European political and economic integration. So it's a deeply historical work, very socially sensitive, and your work more recently during the crisis, which has been quite dense, engages with a very critical and harrowing question: and how can we make finance work for us all better than it does right now? And you set the bar very high there. This is not going to be a reformist, run down the mill kind of approach. This will be a challenging set of diagnoses as well as prognoses about what to do about it. I will make 2 points about the book. I think at the core of it lie 2 concerns. The first is that what we have seen since 2008 has been the manifestation of a structural crisis. This is not a contingent event. Rather, it has been at the core not only of the financial sector and it's the financialization of many private and public goods that has been taking place during the past few decades, but has also been at the core of politics itself. The second aspect is that the underlying contradictions built into financialization overlap with the contradictions of the European political integration project. And that's a very challenging proposition that has been engaged with very empirically in your book. There are 2 aspects of these contradictions. One is the relationship between core and periphery, between the wealthy North and the sort of quote-unquote poor South, and the sort of contradictions embedded in the European monetary integration project, but there's also an internal one that revolves around class relations. At the end of the day, you are a Marxian who takes class seriously, but the imbalance that is embedded in this kind of internal class contradictions lies at the core of your analysis. And that, I think, is an approach that we don't see every day. Not only that we don't see a heterodox economist on a North American campus every day, but we see one that has his own take on it. And that kind of intellectual hybrid that you propose, I think is going to be one that will get a lot of ideas flowing around the room. Without much further ado, Professor Lapavitsis, thank you.
Thank you very much for this presentation. It's very unusual for me. Where I come from and where I work, things pan out differently on a daily basis. But anyway, I'd like to thank you for this very kind opening. And I'd also like to thank the Center for the Study of Europe and thank Boston University for the invite. It's a pleasure to be here. I came to Boston, I've only been here once before. It was a pleasure trip then. Still is a pleasure now, but the pleasure is different because I come to address you, so I hope to have intellectual give and take. I will discuss financialization, what it is in my view, and what to do about it. I will do it in a Greek accent that has been honed in England. So if you're taken aback by the mixture of English sounds and Greek sounds, then it's because of what you get here. So let's see how it works out. I'll do it as slowly as I can, but you can rest assured that my Greek side will come out after about 20 minutes and I will start speaking faster and faster. If you've got difficulty, let me know and I'll slow down. Now, I don't really want to waste any more time, so I'll get on with it. And I'll start with a simple observation, which we can all share. I don't think there's any doubt at all about it, that in modern, mature capitalist economies, the U.S. being one of the leading ones, but not only that, the U.K., Germany, Japan, and so on, France, there's an extraordinary presence of finance now. The presence of finance today and over the last 3 to 4 decades has become simply extraordinary. Finance, the financial sector, but finance generally, has become enormous in terms of size relative to GDP and so on. In terms of the penetration of financial transactions and financial considerations and financial activities throughout economic and social life, and also in terms of policy influence, the shaping of policy, to which I will come back in a minute, is influenced by the concerns of the financial system and the financial sector. So I don't think there's any doubt at all about that. That's, in a sense, it's a dumb fact. The finance has become extraordinarily important. Therefore, I think it's a fair call to say that mature capitalist economies have become financialized. Let's agree on the term, on a sort of casual use of the term, a heuristic use of the term to start with. So we've got financialization right here in front of us, but obviously there is no agreement on how to understand it. The term is becoming more and more popular, more and more widely used, but what is it? So I'll give you my take. What's going to happen here is I'm going to give you my take, and this take I've developed over some time, and you'll find it in this book of mine. So what is financialization? Well, let me come clean and tell you at the outset that I think that financialization represents a structural change of contemporary capitalism. It's basically a historic transformation of the capitalist system if one takes a longer-term perspective. If you want to use an old-fashioned political economy Marxist term, I think it's an era, right? It's an era of capitalist development that basically commenced about 4 decades ago. Like all eras, it didn't become obvious when it started. No one can actually locate these things very easily when they start. They become clear with hindsight. And I think it became clear with hindsight at the end of the previous decade, basically. So if you ask me again, I would say that the term that most appropriately captures what's happened to global capitalism the last 4 decades is not really globalization. I know the term is used extensively, and I use it myself. I don't think really it is globalization. The term which I've never quite understood with enough precision. I would say that really what's happened to global capitalism the last four decades is financialization. I think that's the term that really could potentially capture better the transformation of capitalism in recent decades. So then how to identify it? If that's the case, how to identify it? Now, that's a difficult thing to do. It's no wonder that there is no agreement, because that's inherently a very difficult thing to do if one moves beyond the simple recognition of the size of finance. So how to identify it, how to think about it? Well, in my view, it should partly be done in theoretical terms. You partly need theory. You need to identify changes, real processes taking place in capitalist accumulation that can help you understand and define financialization. That's the first thing that has to happen. In a sense, that's economics and political economy. But that alone is not enough. We've got to start with that, but that alone is not enough. We also need to locate financialization in terms of the evolution of institutions and the evolution of history, to set the terrain, the broader terrain of it. And we need a mixture of the two. In short, what we need is middle-range theory to understand financialization. And middle-range theory is always the most difficult theory to do, because it's not pure theory where you move with the concepts and the abstract concepts. It's not history where you concretely examine the evolution of events and you theorize them. It's actually an in-between thing, and the in-between things are always the most difficult things to do. But the theorization of a period of capitalism, it seems to me, is by construction and by definition middle-range theory. So if that's the case, what is financialization? Well, I would say financialization is basically three fundamental tendencies rooted in capitalist accumulation. Now, I expect that some of you subsequently will ask me, why do we get these tendencies? And I'm prepared to discuss them. But since this is middle-range theory, I don't have to justify or explain where they come from. I simply recognize them, and I validate them empirically. That's enough for middle-range theory, it seems to me. So to me, financialization is three fundamental tendencies rooted in capitalist accumulation. The first tendency has to do with the non-financial enterprises. One must start with the non-financial enterprises, productive and commercial enterprises, the big businesses that make up the bulk of the economy. And when you look at these big businesses, the non-financial enterprises, what can you say about them? Well, it seems to me that what you can say about them are two things which are very important. The first is that big businesses in the last 3 to 4 decades have actually become more independent of banks. There isn't, contrary to what many people think, there isn't actually a coming together of big businesses and big banks in the last 3 to 4 decades. There is actually more and more space opening up between them. And the reason is clear. Big business can finance investment overwhelmingly through retained profits. The ability to finance investment through retained profits is something we observe for a long time in large enterprises. In the last few decades, it's become very clear and very powerful. So big business finances its investment through retained profits. That doesn't mean it doesn't use banks. Of course it uses banks. Of course it has a connection with banks. But its investment is overwhelmingly financed through retained profits, and that gives it independence of banks. So we find space and independence between these two components of the capitalist economy. But at the same time, what we see non-financial enterprises doing is, as they become more independent of banks, they financialize. They become themselves more involved in financial activity on own account. They've acquired financial operations and financial capabilities, and they apply them. They go to market, they undertake financial operations, and they make financial profits themselves. So they financialize. So financialization begins at the level of the non-financial enterprise, which financializes in this complex way that I just summed up. That's the first tendency. The second tendency, I think, has to do with banks, has to do with financial institutions, which obviously have to relate to what happened to the non-financials, and it's clear what the banks would do. The banks remain very much the core of the financial sector anyway. What the banks would do, and they have done, if the non-financials behave in this way, the banks will have to adapt their profit-making. Banks are profit-making businesses. They reinvent themselves constantly. They've always done that in the history of capitalism. And they have reinvented themselves in the last 3 to 4 decades in two ways. The banks have begun to seek profit, not simply from lending to productive enterprises, especially big businesses. They still do that, but that is not where profit-making is at its most successful. The banks have begun to seek profit through transactions in financial markets. It's a shift in the profit-making activities of banks towards profit that comes from transacting in finance rather than lending, fundamentally. And the second thing that the banks have done is to seek to make profits out of lending to households. If you don't make profits, if you can't have good business from lending to big businesses because they finance themselves, then you lend to other people, and other people means households. So the banks have reinvented themselves as financial operators and institutions that aim to lend to households. The third tendency is, in a sense, related to the first two, and it has to do with households and individuals themselves. And what we see there is that households have become transformed in their relation to the financial system. This is, in a sense, the most vivid aspect of financialization historically. What we see is that individuals and households have become more and more closely implicated in the operations of the formal financial system. And they've done so on both sides of the balance sheet, as it were. Households clearly borrow more. The proportion of household debt to GDP in this country and elsewhere has just gone through the roof during the last few decades. So the households borrow more, but households also have more financial assets proportionately. And that's something we shouldn't forget. We shouldn't just look at debt. Households also have financial assets. Why? It's a sort of typical reaction to say it's because wages and real incomes have been stagnant in the last few decades and people have to borrow more to maintain levels of consumption. I'll come back to that in a minute. I understand this and I recognize it, especially in this country where real wages have been stagnant since the early 70s, basically. But I think it's more complex than that. The explanation is more complex than that. It isn't to do simply with the level of wages. It is to do with how households meet their basic needs. Households are not businesses. Right? Households are basically where life is reproduced. And households have got needs for housing, for health, for education, for transport, and so on. Now, how these needs are met depends on the systems and the institutions and history of each country. There are modes of provision. Historically, we've had public provision to a certain extent. But in the last 3 to 4 decades, with the rise of neoliberalism, public provision has been retreating in different ways in different countries, but retreating. What has been taking its place is private provision. Private provision of health, private provision of education, private provision of all these fundamental things. Finance has emerged as the mediator of private provision. Financialization, then, is a complex phenomenon. It has to do with private finance emerging as the mediator of new modes of private provision to households. And this also includes the asset side, because we see it on the pension side and on the insurance side. As private provision of pensions and so on increases, private finance emerges as the mediator of these services. What's the bottom line? The bottom line is that private finance mediates these needs of households, both on the debt side and on the asset side, and makes profit out of both ends. Households have become fields of profit-making for finance. Households have financialized in that way. So these three tendencies to me are basically the foundation of financialization. That's what I understand by financialization. And these three tendencies, I would argue, you can observe with differences, and I will come to it in a minute, across mature capitalist countries. Now then, what else can we say about this period that would have meaning for understanding the current situation. I can say many things, but I haven't got very much time. So I will say, I will point out just three aspects which seems to me matter for where we are and what we can do about it. The first is, in a sense, the rise of new relations of power and hierarchies in the global economy as a result of financialization. The rise of a new imperialism, if you want to call it that. Why and how? The way I've defined and summed up financialization for you now relates to mature capitalist countries. And I said that many times. I make no bones about it. This relates to the US, UK, Germany, Japan, France, countries at that level of development, the historic centers of capitalist accumulation. Within those countries, you can still find differences, of course. And in this book of mine, I acknowledge the differences. You find on the one hand, for instance, the Anglo-Saxon countries, the US and the UK, where financialization isn't quite the same as for Japan and Germany. The role of households, for instance, in the Anglo-Saxon countries is more pronounced than in the case of Japan and Germany. You find, in other words, the historic distinction between market-based finance in Anglo-Saxon countries and bank-based finance in Japan and Germany maintaining itself, in a way, and reproducing itself in the period of financialization. Nonetheless, you can find financialization across the board. There is no doubt that Japan and Germany and France and so on are also financializing with differences. So that much is clear. But that is still a process that comes out of the mature countries, the historic centers of capitalist accumulation. What's been happening in the developing world? This is a new development, in a sense, and a lot of my students are looking into it because that's a process that began to take shape really the last 15 years or so. And in a sense, we can see the true power of financialization by putting our finger on that development. What we see is financialization emerging across a range of middle-income countries now. We see financialization emerging in Brazil, in Turkey, in Mexico, and in countries which you wouldn't call middle-income as a whole, but they've got a middle-income country within them, like India, or countries of that magnitude. We definitely see financialization processes occurring there, too. Those of you who might have studied developing countries will know immediately what I mean in terms of the growth of the financial sectors of these countries in the last 10, 15 years. Now, how are we to understand that? I would argue that this is actually derivative or subordinate financialization. This is financialization that follows and is generated by financialization occurring in the mature countries of the capitalist system. One key way in which this happens and shows you the global reach of financialization is, of course, capital flows. Now, historically, we look at capital flows as a process that takes place from the mature countries, the advanced countries, as it were, to the developing countries. Capital crosses borders and goes to these countries in search of profits, be it from production or from other activities. No doubt this has been going on in the last 15 years with foreign direct investment reaching and sustaining very high levels the last decade and before. If you net it out, you will see that that's not the case, however. If you net it out, you will find a very strange phenomenon. You will find that capital has actually been flowing from the poor to the rich. It might sound strange to you, but that's actually what's been happening. And the reason why capital has actually been flowing from poor to rich on a net basis is because, of course, the poor have been accumulating reserves of dollars, essentially. Fundamentally dollars or sometimes euros. But to accumulate reserves of dollars, you've got to buy U.S. government securities. That's how you hold your dollars. In other words, you send money from India to the United States. This is state-to-state transactions. These are not private agent transactions. But there are state-to-state transactions that are generated because of the logic of the global financial architecture, as it were, and the private capital flows that go from the US to India, say. If you net it out, the US is the beneficiary on a net basis. It receives capital. Why? Because of the role of the dollar. What's the impact of that as far as financialization is concerned? The country that receives the flows, the US in this case, but not only, but mostly the US, obviously can proceed with financialization because these are extra capital flows that can maintain a bubble or sustain the bubble going, keep the bubble going as it happened from 2004 to 2005 and so on. That's well understood. But what's more interesting is what's happening in the country that sends the money. Brazil, South Africa, and so on. What happens there is that the central bank of that country has to sterilize the reserves, has to make sure that the reserves do not produce inflation. And therefore, he has to create new assets, new financial assets, that allow the country to keep reserves without runaway inflation. These new financial assets are usually very liquid. Domestic assets, highly liquid assets. The domestic financial institutions acquire these assets, and then they can expand their balance sheets. So what happens is they begin to financialize. In which direction? In the direction that the new banks, that the banks coming into these countries from the mature countries teach them to do. So what you get is mature country banks that come from countries that have financialized, that know how to lend to households, that know how to play the games in the financial markets, which I summed up for you to start with, go to middle-income countries and train the banks in those countries to play the same game, which now have liquid assets which allow them to do it. It's a little more complex than that. I'm summarizing it ferociously and brutally, but I want to give you the gist of it. The end result is that you get middle-income country financialization proceeding in leaps and bounds with phenomena which actually look sometimes worse than the phenomena of the mature countries when it comes to households. Incredible increases in household debt occurring in places like Turkey, in places like Brazil, in places like India as a result of processes of this type. So this is financialization occurring in a subordinate way, a derivative way, across the world because fundamentally of the role of the dollar and because of the role of the banks of mature countries. I would argue that this is the form that imperial relations, hierarchical relations will take today, and we need a far better understanding of them than we've got at the moment. So that's the first aspect of financialization I want to mention to you. The second aspect that I want to mention to you is what it has done, financialization, what it has done to social structure. And here I will refer to mature countries, although the phenomena that we see in middle-income countries, developing countries, are actually beginning to look pretty similar. What we see in mature countries as a result of financialization of the last four decades is, of course, a transformation, profound change in social structure for two related reasons. The first is the rise of financial profit. Financial profit has become, especially in this country for which we've got the best data, has become an incredible proportion of total profit. Absolutely incredible proportion of total profit. And that's without counting financial profit that accrues from personal transactions or for payments to bank functionaries and so on. This is simply counting the profit of financial institutions. Okay? Financial profit, I would argue, is a very important part of financialization. Financial profit is not like other forms of profit. It's not like industrial profit. It's not like commercial profit. Financial profit can also be a zero-sum game. It can also be simply a transfer. A transfer from someone's income into someone's profit. A transfer from someone's money wealth into someone else's profit account. It has this dimension to it, which industrial profit doesn't. So I would argue that this is an element of financial expropriation, which characterizes financialization, and it gives the basis for the growth, the extraordinary growth of financial profit that we've witnessed the last 3 to 4 decades. Now, who benefits from this financial expropriation and the growth of financial profit? In the past, and sometimes now among post-Keynesians, you hear an argument that financialization is the triumph of the rentier. The rentiers used to be this social class, this social layer that basically lived by owning capital, which you would make available for lending, and you would survive on the coupons, right? On the interest that you would receive from it. And if inflation was fairly steady and the rate of interest was reasonable, then you could live on it if you had a significant amount of capital. So you could be a capitalist that you would survive without actually applying your capital to production. The rentiers in typical political economy analysis would be considered parasites. You can see why. I don't see this class today. I don't see, well, obviously I see individuals who do that, but I don't see that social layer as the dominant layer of financialization. Financial profit, which is huge, doesn't really accrue to a rentier class in my view. It accrues to a different layer which needs better analysis. If we have rentiers today, they are a very strange sort of rentier. They are rentiers who basically draw enormous profit because of location and position in the financial system, because of location and position in the productive mechanism, commercial and industrial enterprises, and relation to the financial system. There are people who work for banks, people who work for large financial institutions, people who run big businesses and get remunerated in financial ways through financial instruments. And you end up making vast profits in the form of salaries and wages. It appears as a bonus, which is a payment for your labor. It isn't labor at all. It's actually profit. But it accrues in this form. It doesn't accrue as interest. And therefore, it defines a social stratum which draws, it has benefited from financialization, but it isn't a rentier stratum in the traditional way. This social layer, I would argue, has been extremely successful at capturing the policymaking process, at influencing the policymaking process, and at shaping economic and social policy in ways that protects its ability to extract this kind of profit, its ability to receive this kind of profit, and that's characteristic of financialization, I would say. The last thing I want to mention, I'm running out of time fairly rapidly, is the third thing about financialization that's worth discussing is, of course, what it has done to ideology, the ideological shift that it represents. That's very, very important, and I want to say a few words about it. I haven't got time to expand on it much as I would have liked to, but I'll say a few things about it. What we see in the period of financialization is, of course, the rise of neoliberalism. There's no doubt at all about it. Neoliberalism is the dominant economic ideology of our era. Neoliberalism is a very strange kind of ideology. It's now so dominant. You find it in so many economics departments. People survive and use it without knowing what they're doing. They think that this is economics, or they think that this is thinking. Well, it isn't thinking. It's a certain type of thinking that has a strong ideological dimension to it, right? In this country, which has been one of the main sources of neoliberalism, it has a very strong outlook of presenting economics or economic and social analysis as a conflict between the state and the market. It's very, very clear to me when I read U.S. Material or when I read the press and so on. It's sort of strongly embedded ideological thing. There's a conflict between the market and the state, and the neoliberals are presumably the ideology that says the market is good, the state is bad, and so on. Neoliberalism is not about that. Neoliberalism is not an ideology that's against the state. That actually is, in a sense, introductory neoliberalism. In truth, and here I agree with Mirovsky's argument in his latest book, neoliberalism is about capturing the state and aiming to use it in order to change economy and society according to neoliberal precepts. It's actually an ideology that, in a sense, likes the state and wishes to use the state. It isn't against the state. And that's something which we've seen very clearly when it comes to finance. Because you won't find neoliberalism more openly manifested than in the realm of finance. And you won't find the state more openly loved and depended upon than in the realm of finance. When it comes to trouble, finance always turns to the state and depends on the state, as I will explain in a minute. So the first ideological dimension of financialization is to have the rise of neoliberalism. For me, neoliberalism is the ideology that's most appropriate to financialization as an era, as a period. What's even more stunning, though, here is the ability of this kind of ideology to penetrate so many aspects of social and private life, to reach into all kinds of nooks and crannies of personal life, individual existence, social life, professional life, to shape mentalities, to shape outlooks, to create a certain approach to life and work, which we find so dominant in the world today. It is to calculate everything in pennies and pounds or in dollars and cents. It is to translate everything into money worth. It is to think that all social values and all social principles can be translated into dollars. And that's how one should measure them and assess them. That, in a sense, is the most pernicious aspect of the ideological shift that we've seen in the period of financialization, emanating from finance to a large extent, and in a sense permeating and polluting society, because it's a kind of pollution, really, as far as I'm concerned. At the same time, and I haven't got time to go into it, I must acknowledge that there are large sections of society that have been resisting this, whether knowingly or unknowingly. Nonetheless, you see the tendency emanating from the dominant sectors of economy and society. Now, what I really want to focus on and finish my talk with is the state. Looking at the state, because when we look at the state, we can work out what we can do about this phenomenon that I've been talking about. So when we look at the state of financialization, I think what we can say is that the first thing we need to say is that financialization, the way I've outlined it, is not really a spontaneous development. I say this because when you do mainstream economics or when you do political economy of a certain disposition, you always want to essentialize things. What I observe has come out of some kind of deeply hidden sort of core. No, that's not the case as far as I'm concerned. Financialization, yeah, it's deeply rooted, but it would have been impossible without the state. The state has made financialization possible. This financialization depends on the state, and it depends on the state in a variety of ways, which I haven't got time to go over it in detail, but I'll sum it up for you. Financialization depends on the state because the state has retained and actually strengthened its monopoly command over the final means of payment, over money. Modern money is created by banks, of course. It's privately created credit money. But this modern money is not convertible into anything of value. The final means of payment is basically another form of credit money created by the central bank, backed by the state. It depends on the say-so of the state. The state has retained this monopoly of a legal tender and actually strengthened it. It hasn't actually conceded that at all. And I say this because if neoliberalism was true to its ideological core, it should have wanted, like Hayek said, a free market in money. Money is the most important commodity, right? If you got free markets in everything, then you must have it over money. And as I say, Hayek knew that. Friedman didn't. Friedman didn't want it because, in some ways, he was a Keynesian. But Hayek understood. Hayek understood, and he wanted a free market in money, which is logical. Right? Do we have a free market in money? No. when it comes to money, the bottom line is complete monopoly. The state has retained monopoly of a legal tender because that's fundamental to running financialization. Without that, it would have been impossible to financialize because, point number two, the central bank wouldn't have had the power it has. The reason why the central bank has got the power it has is because of state monopoly over money. State monopoly over money delivered through the central bank gives to the central bank the ability to create liquidity, which is basically a socially based means of payment. That's basically what it is. When Mr. Bernanke or whatever creates, I should say Professor Bernanke, creates liquidity, this liquidity basically rests on the trust created by the American people. That's what it is. It's socially based liquidity. That gives to the central bank the ability to support banks and to affect the rate of interest. In other words, it rests on a monopoly that the state has maintained over money. So that has been critical to fostering financialization and defending financialization at critical moments. The state, finally, has been fundamental to financialization through regulation and deregulation. And I want to say a few words here. It's often thought that the years of the last 3 to 4 decades, the years of financialization, have been years of deregulation. In some sense, it's true. I said it myself. The financial markets have been deregulated. All sorts of regulation have been lifted. However, if you look at regulation in the round as a whole, you will see that the last 3 to 4 decades have not actually been years of deregulation, but years of re-regulation. We've had regulation up to the eyeballs in the last 3 to 4 decades. That's the truth of it. There's been stacks of regulation. Financialization, in other words, has depended on regulation. There's been plenty of regulation. The question is, what kind of regulation? And here we see that the regulation we've had has been regulation that's been semi-public, not quite public, but semi-public. In other words, operated by institutions that are and are not public, focusing on the individual activities of financial institutions, and above all, aiming to protect the profit-making capabilities of these institutions. This kind of regulation is captured most clearly in the Basel agreements, Basel 1 and 2, and now Basel 3 under construction. That's precisely what these agreements have been about, and in a sense, that's the kind of regulation that is being debated right now following the crisis of 2007-2009. A new bout of regulation of this type, which is actually regulation that we might call market conforming. It's the kind of regulation that the financial institutions like because they run it. They produce it themselves, they shape it themselves, and they put it in operation themselves in a semi-public way, and it protects their profits in the medium term. So the state then has been operating regulation in this way. We've had plenty of regulation of this type in the years of financialization. We've also had regulation of a more generic type. I will call it regulation, and it might surprise you, but it is a kind of regulation. And this regulation has taken the form of lender of last resort intervention. That's a kind of regulation too. Essentially, you change the rate of return by intervening in that way. Regulation that intervention that has been that has decisively protected deposits, deposit insurance. It's a kind of regulation, and that's fundamental to financialization. And of course, regulation that has taken the form of having banks and other institutions that are too big to fail. So, lender of last resort, deposit insurance guarantees, too big to fail, key ways in which the state has supported and sustained and created financialization. In sum, then, financialization is a period in which capitalism has been transformed, a new transformed type of capitalism has emerged, a deeply exploitative system, a system that exploits in complex ways directly through income and other transfers. It's deeply unequal. It's prone to bubbles and crisis. It's a highly unstable system. There's no two ways about it. It's been a period of successive crises, the last 3 to 4 decades, emanating from finance and putting the rest of the economy in deep trouble. What can be done about it? And in the next 5 minutes, I'll tell you what to do about financialization. What can be done about it? Seems to me that financialization is not like other historical periods of historical transformation. When you come from a political economy background, when you come from sort of, you accept Marxist precepts and so on, you always look at capitalism as something that, as a system that produces, in a sense, development, growth, and progress, and you maintain some elements of that, and you aim to transform it into something that's socially beneficial. Not financialization. The social benefits from being able to set derivatives prices across the world in sections of a second are negligible. There is no social benefit that I can see in hiring very high quality physics PhDs to play games with interest rate derivatives. Financialization must be reversed. Right? This is one of these evolution phenomena that must be reversed. So the argument must be the reversal of financialization. But how? What does that mean? Well, we obviously need regulation. Regulation is important, but this kind of regulation must have teeth. It mustn't be the regulation that I've just outlined for you, because we've had plenty of that regulation. So it must be regulation with teeth. So what should this regulation do? Well, it should regulate interest rates, it should regulate credit availability, quantities, and it should regulate the activities, the functional specialization of institutions. It must directly regulate that. It must stop institutions from doing certain things, and it must tell them at which prices and at which volumes to do what they do. The minute you put it in that way, you realize that this is not really possible unless something is done at the global level about exchange rates, of course, and about money being used globally. Because this is now a global system, as I said, and you need to regulate exchange rates. You need to make sure that instability of exchange rates is confronted. You need to do something about the derivatives markets that you get in these prices, which have become enormous. In other words, you need to operate globally to confront, to apply this kind of regulation. Regulation alone is not enough. I say this because in this country, a lot of people believe that if you regulate, you will reverse financialization. No. Regulation alone is not enough. Regulation will always be bypassed by private financial institutions. They will develop ways of bypassing regulation. What we need to do is to look at the failures periodically created by financialization, the biggest one is in 2007-2009, and recognize that these represent the failure of private banking itself and private financial institutions themselves. And that's an argument for public financial institutions. That's an argument about for dealing with ownership, not just regulation. Ownership must be confronted as well. Regulation alone is not enough. Essentially, private banking has failed, and it's failed time and again. What is it good for? What does it do, private banking, other than create periodic crises? So ownership must be confronted, and there, I would argue, we need complex arguments about public ownership. Public ownership to deal with financial institutions that can confront the shortages of investment that we see in mature countries, and also the problems of providing credit to households and others in non-problematic ways, in socially acceptable ways, rather than the problematic ways that the private system does. Except that these public forms of ownership must not be simply nationalization. No one argues for simple nationalization. That's past. That's not what we need. We need new ways of effecting public ownership over finance, ways that would be communal and associational, and ways that would create a new spirit of public service through which financial institutions can operate. I will finish by saying that even ownership is not enough. If you think about financialization and what it is, you will realize that you must do something as well about the implication of households into the formal financial system. If financialization must be reversed, then that implication of households into the financial system must also be reversed. Now, how would you reverse that? Well, you've got to start and you've got to go back to where it comes from. And if it comes from the retreat of public provision and the emergence of private provision mediated by finance, that has to be reversed. So reversing financialization also means devising new ways of recreating public provision. Public provision in education. In this country, student debt has become enormous. So public provision in education, public provision in housing, public provision in health, and across a range of activities that matter for the life of households. These are vital steps in reversing financialization, in making private finance do something that might not be so socially destructive as it has been in the last few decades. In short, I would argue, reversing financialization, which is necessary, is nothing less than rethinking, restricting, and restraining the aggressive, unstable, and exploitative private capitalism of our day that has created no end of problems. That is ahead of us, and I hope that some progress is made in this regard in the years to come. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Professor Kostas Lapavitsis from the Department of Economics at the University of London. Professor Lapavitsis' lecture was titled Profiting Without Producing, How Finance Exploits Us All. It was presented by the Center for the Study of Europe, the Center for the Study of Asia, the Program in East Asian Studies, and the Undergraduate Economics Association at Boston University. Tonight's moderator was Cornell Ban, Assistant Professor of International Relations at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Marquise Neal. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.